Maybe its influence fluctuates. Maybe there was a surge at the exact moment of the first experiment, but normally it doesn't reach any further than that little room.
So if there were some way to gain access to that room...
For the first time since Optimus Prime disappeared, the pregnant sense of last night, the nearness of something overwhelming, pervades the basement again, filling the corners and slowly building. That's when Skippy's phone beeps with a new message. And each of them realizes, before he even looks at Skippy's dumbstruck face, that he knows who it's from. The night of the breakup, Hallie slept on the sofa. She wouldn't take the bed, no matter how he pleaded with her. It was plain she would have preferred to go, if she'd only been able to summon the energy. Howard was surprised at the way she'd capitulated. He had expected screaming, punches, excoriation. Instead, she simply sank onto the couch, as if he'd sapped her across the back of the head. She cried longer and harder than all the other times he'd seen her cry put together. And he could not comfort her. He was transformed into some monstrous creature whose touch brings only pain. The next morning, she left. He has not seen her since. He guesses she is staying with one or other of the motley straggle of friends she has assembled in her time here. People from work, Americans she'd met on expat forums, other emigres and castaways who'd found themselves stranded on the margins of Dublin life. She calls to the house when he's not there to collect her belongings. Every time he comes home from work, some new small thing is gone, as if he's being burgled in installments. The house feels different without her. Though she still has clothes in the wardrobe, though her hairdryer still sits atop the dresser, her razor on the shelf in the shower, the rooms seem bare, denuded. Her absence dominates the house, becomes, oxymoronically, a kind of physical presence, shaped and palpable. As though she moved out, and this emptiness moved in to take up the space she left. There is a new kind of silence that the stereo turned up all the way can only fill one side of. The air that meets him when he unlocks the door now is clean and clear, smokeless, odorless, breathable.
"I just wish you hadn't gone and told her about Orly,"
Farley says.
"You could have done it without telling her that."
"It wouldn't be fair, just giving her half the story."
"You've burned your bridges now, though. She won't take you back."
Howard sighs.
"What could I do, Farley? If your hand's in the fire, you know?"
"How's that?"
"Something my dad used to say. If your hand's in the fire, eventually you have to accept that the only solution is to take it out. Orly was the catalyst, that's all. It would have happened sooner or later."
But he's not sure this is true. If he hadn't met Orly, maybe it would never have happened. Maybe he would never have found the courage to leave Hallie. Maybe he'd have stayed with her, got married, and lived the rest of his life without ever knowing what real love could feel like. How singular. How incandescent. How complete. Orly changed everything. And the truth is that when he confessed to Hallie, he did it in part for her, as a kind of prayer to her. A declaration of faith on which to found a different kind of life. An attempt as well, to conjure her back from whatever cloud she'd vanished behind. She never came back after midterm break. According to the automator, unforeseen circumstances had forced her to extend her holiday. Every day, Howard sees her classes trooping despondently from the geography room to the study hall, or carrying votive bundles of cardboard and paper to the recycling bins, their faces anxious, hopeful, like Indians doing a rain dance. He knows how they feel. Since midterm, he's existed in a constant state of tension, braced against every moment as the one that might finally restore her. Even out of school, even on his own, shopping in the supermarket, sitting at the traffic lights, he finds himself holding his breath. But the days are a series of ghost pregnancies, delivering nothing. Unforeseen circumstances. He can imagine what, who, that means. Seabrook was supposed to be a career break for her, a transitional phase. She hadn't intended to get mixed up with anyone, especially not someone already mixed up with someone else. Now she's wondering what she's got herself into, and whether there's still time to get herself out. If only he could talk to her. If only he could let her know that this is real to him. More real than anything that has happened before. Or better yet, magically transport the two of them to the time in the future when they've started out on a life together. The chaos and agony of these interim weeks already faded. The blizzard of flyaway moments that is the past, replaced by something exhilarating, serene, lit from within. As for Hallie, except for Farley, he tells no one that she's gone. Remembering what happened to Jim Slattery all those years ago, he's haunted by the thought that somehow the boys will find out. But so far, the news appears not to have reached them. In fact, he finds his classes going unusually well, the second years in particular. Thanks to his midterm reading on the First World War, which, having nothing better to do, he'd continued after Hallie left, Howard finds himself able to speak about his subject from a rare position of authority, and to his surprise, the boys listen. Listen, speak, formulate theories. In the limbo days after midterm, while he waits for Aurelie to return and his new life to begin, these classes, which have so often resembled trench warfare themselves, a huge amount of labour and bloodshed for a dismally small area of terrain, becomes something he actually looks forward to. This weekend is his first as a single man for almost 3 years. He has neglected to make plans, and spends most of it in his house. It feels, at the start, a lot like the times his parents left him home alone as a teenager. He is free to stay up as late as he wants, listen to music as loud as he wants, eat what he wants, drink what he wants, download porn, belch, walk around in his boxer shorts. By 7 o'clock, he is drunk. By 8, the novelty is worn off, and he finds himself slumped over the kitchen table, watching the microwave defrost a frozen spring roll. Then he hears the key turn in the door, and Hallie walks in. Both of them freeze. She by the light switch, he at the table. It is a moment quite electrifying in its cold, untempered immediacy. Not quite like seeing a ghost, more like discovering, in the face of another, that you have become a ghost yourself.
I didn't think you'd be here,
Hallie says.
Yeah,
is all Howard can think to say. He wishes he was wearing trousers.
Can I get you something? Tea?
He doesn't know quite what tack he should take with her. Chastened? Solicitous? Tender? Stoic? The question is moot.
Someone's waiting,
she says, gesturing towards the road where an indistinct figure sits inside a car. She goes to their bedroom and begins to throw things in a box. He waits in the kitchen for her to finish, which she does in 15 or 20 minutes. Whisking back through the house and bidding him good night with all the warmth of a solicitor's letter. Then she is gone, and he is left with the hum of the electricity, to go into the bedroom, if he so desires, and see what she has taken. He drinks the rest of the beer and goes to bed early, but he can't sleep. The bereaved dog across the road has taken to howling into the small hours of the night. Long ululations, laden with rage and grief for its lost companion. Howard lies there for an hour or two, listening to the howls and watching the ceiling. Then, with a sigh, he throws back the sheets and goes down to the kitchen, to sit at the bar with one of his library books. Now overdue, and subject to a fine, the borrowing sheet pasted to the flyleaf informs him sternly of 1 penny a week. He's read so many books about the war at this point that he's in danger of becoming a buff. He's even started to develop ideas. At some point in his reading, he realized the conflict had coalesced into 2 separate wars. The first, the War of the Generals and the Dons, as well as the dull school textbook, proliferates with causes, strategies, notable battles, and is fought in the moral light of the so-called big words. Tradition, honor, duty, patriotism. In the other war, however, the one the soldiers actually experienced, these features are nowhere to be found. In this war, any kind of overarching meaning, even straight enmity between the two sides, seems to dissolve into nothing, and the only constants are chaos, destruction, and the sense of being lost in a machinery too huge and powerful to be understood. The very battlefields of this war, so clearly delineated on the arrow-strewn relief maps of the first, are deracinated, volatile, pitching themselves up without warning into the sky, to make landmarks, place names, measurements, meaningless. The two disparate accounts remind Howard strangely of what Farley said in the ferry that night about the differing explanations of the universe, the relativistic and the quantum, or the very large and very small. The generals during and the Dons after it wanted more than anything else for the war to make sense, to embody the classical concept of conflict, to look, in short, like a war. Just as Einstein tried to fit all of creation into his one perfect geometric scheme. But in the same way that the subatomic particles defied any attempt at explaining them, rebelled towards an ever more violent schemelessness and disorder, so the war, the more its leaders insisted on the contrary, spiraled into incomprehensibility. The more soldiers in their tens and hundreds of thousands were wiped out. From those soldiers' perspective, meanwhile, the war was one sprawling, senseless confusion. A 4-year horror story with no discernible point, other than to belie not only the general's causes and big words, but the very idea of a comprehensible and God-sanctioned world, which seems to Howard nicely quantum. If nothing else.
You could argue that the Great War was, in historical terms, like the Big Bang, a singular event for which none of our explanations is sufficient, but which at the same time our whole civilization is founded on. The force of it blew the century apart, from a strictly ordered regime where everyone knew their place, where everything was arranged in nice, harmonious symmetries. The Western world entered a period of great turbulence and discord. What the poet T.S. Eliot called an immense panorama of futility and anarchy, which, arguably, we are still living in today. At the same time that Einstein was working on the theories that would completely overturn classical ideas of what space and time were, how reality worked, the war was reordering our whole concept of civilization. Empires centuries old disappeared overnight. People lost faith in institutions they had trusted without even thinking about it. Like a child trusts its parents. The old world fell, and our modern world was born, as a direct result of the war. Not so much from the outcome of the fighting, as from the terrible things the soldiers, ordinary men, had seen and endured. So what was the war like for that ordinary soldier? To even get to the front, he would have marched 20 miles a day, carrying equipment weighing anything from 40 to 100 pounds. While in the front line, he might spend an entire day standing up to his armpits in muddy water. He rarely slept for more than 2 hours at a time, and exhaustion was one of the major sources of trauma during the conflict. In fact, almost 50% of the casualties during the war on the Western Front came not from battle, but from the conditions the men were living in. Trench foot, head lice, rats. The war was a boom time for rats. Two of them could produce over 800 offspring in a single year. So soon there were tens of millions of them, flocking to the corpses.
The boys listen with open mouths. They eat up details like this. The gruesomer the better. But what harm is that? Isn't the main thing that they are actually interested? Although, admittedly, not everyone sees it that way.
I'm just wondering if this stuff is going to be in the exam.
Jeekers Prendergast says in his twangy, nervous voice.
I mean, if it's not covered in the book...
The class groans, but Jeekers holds his ground.
It's just that, according to your lesson plan, we're supposed to be doing the Easter Rising this week.
Yeah, when are we going to do some Irish history?
Jeekers finds an unlikely ally in the form of Murish de Valdraha, piping up disaffectedly from the back row. Howard spreads his hands placatingly.
I promise, we have time for both.
His head snaps round involuntarily at the sound of wheels on the gravel outside. Could it be? But no, it's just Father Green, returning from one of his errands. He collects himself and returns to the boys.